Welcome to the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest or podcast. It's a panel discussion of what we regard as the most interesting published papers of relevance to pediatric orthopaedic surgeons. Please do remember the views are our own and not those of the BISCOS board, committees or membership. Check, 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 mic check. I always wanted to do that. So guys, welcome. It's the BISCOS podcast, pod meaning Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest cast. I'm one of your hosts. I'm Anish Singrajka from the Norfolk and Norwich and the Education Committee of BISCOS.
I'm Alpesh. I'm from Oxford and I'm on the ResCom Research Committee.
And today we have our special guest, Sally Hobson, joining us from Hull. And big shout out to producer Pranay Budev as well from Broomfield. So why are we doing this? There are loads of podcasts out there. Why add another one? Well, frankly, it's because this is all about pediatric orthopedics for pediatric orthopedic surgeons, and we're not tied to any particular journal. So whereas a lot of the other ones you'll listen to have to push their papers or their allied publications, we're not going to do that. And we're trying to find papers. We've read about 35 different journals. Sally was really pleased to be joining us for this. 35 different journals for the last 3 months so that you guys don't have to. And we're going to provide you with a really decent summary of what we found so you can pretend you did all the hard work. So moving on, right? So Sally, thank you very much for joining us today. I've known you, I think it's been about 11 years now since we were at Sydney together.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, and then I'm going to hand over to Alpesh, actually. So he's going to ask you a few questions about you and your unit, just so that our listeners and us get a better idea.
Okay,
well, that's great. Thanks, Anish. Hi, Sally. Really nice to meet you. About the similar time last year when we were talking about the podcast, Anish has been raving about you and couldn't wait to have you.
It must have been that money I sent him.
Inaugural episode. So obviously we've not met and some of the listeners may not know you. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and about your unit and your specialist interests, please.
Basically I work at Hull Royal Infirmary. I've been a consultant there for very close to 10 years. I did my fellowship, as Anish said, in Sydney, the Westmead Children's Hospital, which was great fun. And my main speciality is paediatric orthopaedics. I do also do adult trauma. I'm based, as I say, at Hull Royal Infirmary, but I do work one day a week, go out to York and support York and Scarborough patients with clinics and day case operating there. I've got three other colleagues who contribute to paediatrics at Hull. All of us are on a general trauma rota, so we don't have a separate paediatric rota, but we do see a pretty reasonable breadth of stuff of paediatric orthopaedics, it's a really great unit to work in.
Great. And what's your sort of specialty interest?
I'm pretty generalist, really. I wouldn't say that I've got one particular area, because particularly working in York means that I see the full breadth of things, really. I don't do terribly much upper limb, so there's a bit of upper limb stuff that might refer on to plastics, but I wouldn't say that I do, you know, more DDH than feet or anything like that. So I quite like remaining fairly general.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. And in recovering from COVID, are you guys back firing all cylinders?
Yeah, I think, well, certainly compared to our adult colleagues, I think we've got off extremely lightly, or certainly our patients have got off extremely lightly. We stopped kind of operating from March until August last year, And then we had another brief stoppage November, December last year. But really, since through the whole of this year, we've had our elective lists and day case lists back. So, you know, I think some patients may have waited up to a year, but not really got much more than that. And anything urgent, we've been able to accommodate. The, as I say, the adult elective side is absolutely abysmal. So we've been very fortunate in that regard.
Okay, that's great. Something Anish told me about was that in 2019, you were BOTA Trainer of the Year. So it's clearly something very important to you and close to your heart. We're always looking for methods to improve our training method, you know, training our trainees, and just wondering what tips you've got and what things you've found useful to get the most out of your trainees.
Well, yeah, I mean, I absolutely love teaching and training, and I mean, I really love my job, as sad as it sounds. And when someone comes to work with me, I really want to inspire them to really enjoy it and be good at it as well. So I guess it helps to be kind of enthusiastic. Other things are, I feel quite passionately that when a trainee comes, that we ought to be offering them training. So they're not coming to be like a dog's body and do like the drudgery. You know, they're there for kind of some quality learning. And usually along the way, they want to help me with the drudgery, but that's not what the prime reason they're with me. So I like in clinic to try and run when they're seeing the patients as either a short or an intermediate case, depending on like what the case mix is. And in theatre, I have this thing I really like running through with the trainee on the whiteboard beforehand exactly what they're going to do, so that they can convince me they know what they're doing, and then try and let them do really the approach and as much of the procedure as possible, no matter how complex. And then I'll tend to close the wound and let them go off and write the op note and reflect on it, so that you know, we also means that you claw back a bit of time, because then if you've lost a bit of time with them doing the procedure, hopefully my suturing is a little bit faster and makes a bit of time back for the theatre list. So, and I only do that because someone that I used to work with when I was a registrar did that, and I thought, wow, this is lovely. And so, you know, that really inspired me to want to do that for others as well.
Are you allowed to name drop? Who was that person?
So Mr. Brudrick, Alan Brudrick in Nottingham, who when I told BOTA about this, they spelt his name completely wrong in the article. So he's probably cursing me for that. But yeah, he was a great guy.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience, actually. We've had a trainee join us quite recently, knowing that they want to do paediatric orthopaedics all their whole training. And within 4 weeks of working for us, they've decided against it.
Truly inspirational.
Yes, you know. Big shout out to that trainee, they know who they are.
So one final question, Sally. Most importantly, what is your knowledge of Christmas music like?
Probably not as good as Anish's.
Okay, we might be getting tested in a bit.
Right, thank you very much, guys. So in terms of the format, just for our listeners, we're going to be talking about a few papers. Each of us have been scouring the literature of the last 3 months. So we've all produced a different list of what we think is important. Each of us, including Sally, are going to talk about one paper in a little bit of detail, but this isn't journal club. Okay, this is just you hopefully driving your car, listening to us as you do so, or maybe exercising, or maybe just lying on your bed, relaxing, listening to our voices, doing whatever you might be doing. But by the end of this 45 minutes, you're going to be able to tell your friends some interesting facts about paediatric orthopaedics or Christmas music, one of the two, okay, maybe both. So with that, can we get you, Sally, to talk about your paper for this session?
Okay, so I selected leg length discrepancy in patients with Perthes disease, a note of caution for the arthroplasty surgeon. And this has come from the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital and is in the November BJJ. Obviously, you guys have been scouring the last 3 years worth of literature, but I picked up the last episode of the BJJ that was lying on the side.
You didn't want to say.
I mean, I was a little bit concerned when you invited me to this that it was going to be expose my lack of statistical and research knowledge. But anyway, it's probably been good CPD for me. Anyway, so this paper I chose just because it caught my eye, because it's something of clinical relevance to my practice and something that I've thought about before. And I've always been a little bit cautious about wanting to do, in fact, I haven't done many epiphyseodeses in patients who've got a limb length discrepancy for exactly this reason, that I've said to the patient, well, when you have a hip replacement, it's probably going to leave your leg longer again. So I've always been a little bit hesitant about it. So basically, key thing in this paper is that they looked at all patients who had perthes who had had long leg alignment films, and they looked at the proximal femoral height and the subtrochanteric length. And these were defined by a point at the tip of the greater trochanter. So from the proximal bit being the top of the femoral head to the tip of the trochanter, and the subtrochanteric length being from the tip of the trochanter and down, which I think still actually the subtrochanteric length is taking into account a bit of the neck length. So it is still having some effect there. The things that I thought were interesting about the kind of in terms of the method and the results and so on were the indication for the epiphyseodesis, which was more than 2 centimetre leg length discrepancy, which obviously sounds fairly sensible. And I was interested in the proportion of patients that had an epiphyseodesis, so I could kind of compare it to what I do. And it was about a quarter, 26.6%. I wonder if that's a little bit skewed because they looked at, they only included patients with perthes who'd had long leg alignment films. So that, you know, may not mean that they do epiphyseodesis on a quarter of all their perthes patients, but certainly it seemed to be a higher number than I've been doing. And I think the four main conclusions that they reached were in some ways fairly obvious, but I think extremely valuable to have written down. So the leg length discrepancy in perthes comes from the proximal segment, fairly obvious. That the epiphyseodesis with lengthen the sub or cause relative lengthening of the subtrochanteric segment. That those with a higher Stuhlberg grade end up with more shortening, also fairly obvious. And those with a valgus osteotomy who've had a valgus osteotomy end up with less shortening because obviously we've lengthened the femoral neck. So I think the main thing that they wanted to highlight was for the total hip replacement surgeon that these patients who've had an epiphyseodesis need to have a long leg film at the time of their total hip because they might need a subtrochanteric osteotomy. And they've got a picture of that in the paper, which I thought, well, that looks pretty serious to do a hip replacement and a subtrochanteric osteotomy. And obviously the other thing they were highlighting was to consent, when we're consenting our patients to have this procedure done to correct their leg lengths, that they understand the implications and ideally that they mention to their hip replacement surgeon in 20 or 30 years time, whether, you know, that they've had this done and it might be a consideration. So that was the summary. I mean, I think, as I say, it made some fairly had some fairly obvious results, but really good to highlight them to people. I think the thing that I thought it could have mentioned was whether we should be doing more valgus osteotomies rather than an epiphyseodesis. I remember when we were in Sydney, they were doing some kind of funny neck lengthening osteotomy to restore the biomechanics, although it's obviously a significantly greater procedure than epiphyseodesis. But, you know, maybe we should be thinking about doing that, and then it's more likely to be better for them when they do have a hip replacement.
Unless, of course, we muddy the ground for the hip replacement. That's the problem with all of this stuff, isn't it? And I guess what you'd want to do is discuss that with your arthroplasty colleagues in a kind of which of these is going to be the lesser evil. But I think you're right, isn't it? It's a really obvious thing once they point it out, but probably something that none of us really thought about. But then the same is going to apply to DDH and a whole load of other things that we do epiphyseodesis for. And I don't know what the hip surgeons are going to do with this. Are they going to be templating off the normal hip, or do they try and just restore the mechanics to what they've got on that side, which are abnormal? So I think it opens up a whole can of worms, really, doesn't it? Which we won't have to deal with because we hand them over at 16 to 18.
And it won't be our problem. Easier just to do an epiphyseodesis, really, isn't it? Yeah.
you were saying at the start, actually, that you don't really do this very often. And I was wondering whether that was potentially a conclusion that they could have come to, and they said, look, this is going to be a complex primary as it is. Let's not make it too complex by muddying the water. And if it is the sort of greater Stolberg grade that's going to have the bigger shortening, they're going to be the ones who are going to get the hip replacement earlier as well.
Yeah. And,
you know, the classic papers, Ippolito, Stolberg, they were getting their hip replacement 20, 30 years, but that's probably because they didn't want to do them earlier, but now they probably would get them earlier. And you think, well, deal with a couple of centimeters leg length discrepancy, and then it can all be righted. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was going to ask you guys as really well-read literature people, because I thought one of a couple of the key things that you want to know is really what is the actual rate of these kids ending up having a total hip replacement, and at what age are we talking? I mean, I found something that had got mean 21-year follow-up after a diagnosis of Perthes, and 13 out of 100 hips had had a hip replacement, and a further 7 had OA. So that's only 1 in 5 of the patients at 21 years. Now, I mean, they've still got a long way to go, but that's maybe not as high as I thought it would be. And then weighing that against what's the actual, we're all taught that if you've got a longer leg, you might get arthritis in the joints of the longer leg and you might ruin your back and things like that. But is there any evidence of that? Do we have evidence that they're going to get crippling arthritis in their back if we leave them with a leg length discrepancy of 2.5 centimetres?
So I always go with the less than 2, you're okay, isn't it? There's that whole thing that showed that actually less than 2 centimetres, those risks are low. And even when they've done gait analysis, they've shown that actually there isn't an increased demand on the patient. So for me, 2 centimeters at maturity wouldn't be an issue. I'd leave them alone anyway. And you almost want them to be shorter on the worst side so that they're not putting quite so much weight through. And I guess this is the stuff. These are the discussions you have to have with the patients, talk them through all of this. And it sounds like all of us certainly would be steering away from an epiphyseodesis unless it was going to be a very significant limb length discrepancy. What about you, Alpesh? Have you done many for Perthes?
I haven't, actually. One thing I was going to pick up on, actually, I don't know whether you guys noticed this. So they commented on, the authors commented on that if they had a leg length discrepancy of more than 2 centimetres. But then when you look at their mean leg length discrepancy, it was 2.7 centimetres with a range of 1.3 to 3.4. Yeah. So it sounded like that actually they were doing these epiphyseodesis even when the discrepancies weren't that great. I'm not sure I would necessarily do it when it's that range, especially because our calculation of these differences and the precision by which we can correct the leg length discrepancy is not great in itself. So you kind of want to have something to work with, don't you, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I was a little bit confused by some of the stats in the tables about the difference in the femoral lengths and the tibial lengths and things. Some of the things and it didn't seem to add up. But I was assuming that was just my lack of understanding rather than an issue with the stats. But yeah, like you say, the epiphyseodesis group, it did have a range 1.4 to 4.3, so they weren't quite sticking to their plan.
I agree, and that was my conclusion too. This paper has got Professor Eastwood and Mr. Najad. They clearly know much more than I do, so I just I just accepted it as gospel. I'm sure everything made sense. Brilliant. Right, thank you very much. That was really interesting. So we're going to move on, and in terms of, we cannot cover all of the papers from the last 3 months in this detail. So one of the other things we're going to do is a little bit of bite-sized stuff, so just headlines. Alpesh, fire away with yours. I feel like we should do some news flash music.
Okay, in one. So I'm going to start with a paper about recycling. So we're just off the back of COP26 and from the annals from the Royal College of Surgeons, November, Harris et al. Basically, they just did a survey of members of the Royal College of Surgeons and said, is recycling something important to you, and is this something we should be doing in the workplace? Unsurprisingly, most people said yes, and it was felt that the main barrier is really lack of leadership, which, we're trying to do a bit of recycling in Oxford, but I'm kind of focused on the operation, and I can't really worry about whether, the bottom of the gown packet is recyclable or the plastic is single use. It's difficult. I think I need someone else to focus on that, but at least there's a dialogue about this. And the other thing in theatre, recycling is important, but we probably still need to think about the patient and the patient's asleep. And so this leads me on to my next paper, which looks at the effect of general anaesthetic on our patients. And there's something that I think about periodically. And this was, what was it? It's from the BJA, the British Journal of Anaesthesia from November, out of the Mayo Clinic.
Guys, can I just pause you there? This is the length we've gone to, okay? We've had to read the BJA. You didn't, that wasn't, you did hear him correctly, the British Journal of Anaesthesia. He has gone into places no one else would want to go. Sorry, Alpesh, carry on.
Yeah, well, okay, thanks. You just stopped me mid-flow there. Yeah. What am I going to do? But yeah, so they had quite a big cohort of patients. I think 185,000 children that they looked at, and looked at the rates of ADHD and autism. And they concluded basically that repeated exposure to anaesthetic agents, there was an association between that and increased rates of ADHD. And, you know, it was a pretty good study out of Mayo Clinic, big numbers. That makes me think twice about certain things. So I often do a two-stage cava varus foot reconstruction, like Vince Mosca recommends, and it seems to work quite well. But if someone has bilateral feet, you're signing them up potentially to four anaesthetics in a relatively short duration. So it's making me reevaluate my approach to this, maybe working doing bilateral cases and trying to minimize the exposure to anaesthetic. Do you guys think about the anaesthetic burden at all?
I personally, when I read this, I don't know, you're again probably a lot more clever than me about these things, and you probably obviously read the Pediatric Anaesthesia Journal very, very thoroughly. But I don't understand how they can conclude that the general anaesthetics caused the ADHD as opposed to the cause and effect being the other way round, because could this not just mean that children who have ADHD are more likely to have had lots of procedures at a young age, you know, so they're the kind of kids that are going to be in up all night crying, so someone's going to assume it's their tonsils and take their tonsils out and end up doing so. I'm not quite sure how they proved in this that the anaesthetics had caused the ADHD rather than it actually was there in the first place and that meant they had more procedures.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I don't think it's talking about causality, it's just saying an association. But I guess it just makes me think that if there is any chance an anaesthetic could, if there was causality, then, you know, maybe trying to mitigate our use in our patients would only be a good thing, especially considering no one really knows how anaesthetics work anyway. So.
No, not even the anaesthetist, right?
So other things apart from our patients getting ADHD is also, there was a paper out of JAMA Pediatrics, I think it was, looking at the changes in body mass index in our patients during the COVID-19 pandemic. And this was in JAMA from, I think it was September, November. So Wolford et al. Out of California, and they looked at 190,000 kids. And the numbers they had were slightly crazy in that overweight or obesity in 5 to 11-year-olds increased from 36.2% to 45.7% during the pandemic. And in the older age groups, it also increased, but not to as great an extent. Now, their starting point was pretty heavy, to be honest. But I'm seeing it in my practice as well. Patients are certainly getting bigger and bigger. I don't know whether I do enough in terms of liaising with the other services to help with this. And what do you guys do to help with their nutrition, weight in adult practice? Sometimes they don't operate on patients because of their weight. You know, is this something we should be doing in pediatrics?
I wouldn't not operate on someone because of their weight. I have in the past referred them to healthy eating clinics and the dietitian. And unfortunately, most of those families then come back saying, oh, well, all they did was tell us to watch what he ate. And I sometimes find it very difficult even approaching the subject, actually. You know, you're sitting in your clinic, and you know that it's going to be a difficult conversation. And I have to be honest, I do sometimes shy away from it. I think things like pirthates, where we know that actually it's an adverse risk factor for progression, I'll be a bit more clear about and explain. One of my colleagues actually has just suggested a really good thing, because I said I'm a bit scared about talking about this. What he suggested is there is a BMI calculator on the web, and you can basically put it up on the screen. Every patient gets heighted and weighted. And so in front of them, put up the BMI calculator so that you're doing it for every child. And apparently it changes color. So it will say in big writing whether you are overweight or obese. And I thought, well, maybe that's a better way of doing it. Rather than me broaching the subject, just have it on a big screen so they can see. But then you're right. What do you do about that? What about you, Sally? What do you talk about this to the families?
Well, I'm just giggling to myself now because I'm envisaging people walking into your clinic room, standing on a weight plate and a big kind of red light coming on above them. Big BMI. As you say, I think it's difficult. I mean, I have a normal to low BMI myself. So I think it is a bit hard to sit in front of the patient and say, well, look how fat you are. So I normally have a standard line of saying, well, you know, your symptoms would be better if you lost a bit of weight. I know it's easier said than done. But I think the thing is that it is a really sensitive subject, isn't it? So, you know, I think you're not allowed these days to say, oh, you know, you, if you say you've got a high BMI, you're saying they're fat, and people don't like that and think that you're being rude and mean. So I think it is really hard to broach, and generally if there's a patient where it's really very relevant for, then I would write to the GP and ask them to refer them to a dietitian. But like I said, I've never come across anyone that's actually had any kind of useful outcome following that kind of intervention. So yeah, I think it's difficult to deal with, isn't it?
Well, that was a good discussion, but I feel like my bite size points have been detracted from now, so I'm gonna sneak a couple in quickly. More pediatric orthopedic base. So one from JPO, I think it was in November, looking at serum cytokines to differentiate pediatric septic arthritis and transient synovitis. So that was clever et al. From Washington and St. Louis. They looked basically at a panel of various cytokines to see if they could use these serum markers to better define septic arthritis and transient synovitis. And they found that they had a shortlist of four, and if you use these four, you're potentially good at defining these things. However, their gold standard, what they were comparing to, is actually just the traditional methods, be it bloods combined with clinical examination and then imaging as appropriate. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg scenario, really, because you're comparing your cytokines to what you say is the gold standard. And then if it doesn't meet that, then should you not stick with what you have?
Yeah.
But I think it's an interesting development. And obviously there haven't really been much developments in the last 15 years with regards to our diagnosis of septic arthritis. So I think there's some avenues here, and they put it as a pilot study. So I think watch this space. It could be useful, especially in patients who maybe can't communicate very well, particularly young babies and things like that, neonates, where it can be very difficult to diagnose, and you don't necessarily want them to take them to theatre willy-nilly. And then my final pediatric orthopaedic paper is out of CHOP, Baghdadi et al., and this was looking at non-ossifying fibromas. And the only reason really why I picked this was that they introduced a new sign called the Pac-Man sign. And you know, I'm loving these 80s arcade games. I mean, ultimately, the bulk of their paper was that if you have a really big distal tibial non-ossifying fibroma, which has thinned the cortex, then you are likely to fracture. And if you add up various scoring and you have a Pac-Man sign, you really need to think about doing something prophylactically. So I enjoyed that.
So I'm interested to know, have you ever seen a fracture through a non-ossifying fibroma?
I operated on one last week. And it was 2 weeks old, and it was an absolute pig.
Yeah, I've seen one in a distal femur that I actually treated non-operatively because it just seemed, it wasn't particularly displaced. It seemed wrong to say, let's do something to it. But that was the first time, and that was only a couple of years ago. So I spent most of the rest of the time going, no, these things never break, don't worry.
I must be due one then.
Yeah. That's interesting what you say about the Pac-Man sign. Sally, what was it like in the 80s? Can you let us, you know, we weren't there.
I don't know, the kind of the alcohol in university erased anything I could remember about my childhood.
Okay, so here we go. Okay, we promised Christmas songs. I'm choosing an easy one so that first person in, just shout. Here we go.
Oh, Fairy Tale of New York.
Oh, very good, very good. Okay, can I sneak one more in? Okay, so something not quite. So I always get these ones. Okay, we're not going to say much more. I'm going to let it carry on.
I wish it could be Christmas.
Yes. Can you say by who? Because I always get it the wrong way around.
Slade.
No. See, that's what I always say. It's Wizard.
Wizard.
I always say Slade too. But yeah, okay. That's just my Christmas music. There was one other. I was going to play Run DMC Christmas in Hollis, but I think no one is going to get that one. Right. Okay.
I knew Al Tesh would kill me at that.
It's my specialist subject. It's my prowess.
At the Easter pub quiz, waiting for the Christmas songs.
At least you didn't make us sing along.
Oh, you've worked out what we're doing at the end, have you? Right, okay, so I'm going to move on to my big paper for this 3 months. And it's a paper that I think is really interesting. It's Journal of Children Orthopaedics, October 2021. And it is from our alma mater, Sally, the Children's Hospital Westmead in Sydney. So Oliver Burke, Justine St. George, you've got David Little and Paul Gibbons on there. And so the guys in Sydney do a huge number of modified Dunn procedures for slip capital femoral epiphysis. They've got a massive catchment population and they've spent a lot of time and detail writing this paper up. I've got to say, it's one of the best papers I think I've seen in terms of detail about the procedure, the steps they've taken and how things have evolved. And I'm not just saying that because I worked there. So we were only there for a year at the very beginning of this. This is 218 cases over 10 years, so massive series. The problem I have with the modified Dunn is apparently in Switzerland, people get 0% rates of ABN, however they do it, whenever they do it. Other centers haven't found the same. So there was a multi-center trial, wasn't there, in America, where they showed that their results were nowhere near as good. And that's why I think this is a very interesting paper. And I think it's one that we should be using as a benchmark. So what they do for their severe slips, when they're doing the Dunn, they will put in an ICP bolt monitor into the femoral epiphysis when they're dislocating the head. And they look at pulsatile waveforms. After surgery, they get a SPECT CT. And so out of the 218, they had 178 available for analysis. The mean follow-up was 2.7 years. 71 of these were unstable slips. And all they've said were moderate or severe. The mean slip angle, so the posterior sloping angle was 62. The range was 35 to 90. So that means that they did have a few, you know, pretty mild moderates in there, if you see what I mean. Their non-viable rate, which I'm taking to mean ABN, was 31% in the unstable group. So that is actually still quite high. But what I like about this paper is that they've been honest about this and they've really broken it down into the categories and the subgroups. And then they look at what factors. So they say that the intra-op monitoring was useful in predicting viability. The SPECT CT was, sounds like it was the gold standard for them. In the viable group, the mean time to surgery was 4.6 days compared to 2.7 days in the non-viable group. So actually the non-viable group got taken to theatre quicker. One of the things they say is that the timing doesn't seem to make a difference. But when you look at their figures, what they said was that the ABN rate, or the non-viable rate, was 37.5% when operated within 24 hours, 34% if between 1 and 7 days. And after 7 days, it was 25%. So that's not statistically significant, but I do wonder whether that's because of the sample size. But 37% and 25% sound pretty different, really. The other thing with this operation is they report a 27.5% complication rate. ABN was the biggest complication. There was a 4% dislocation rate, which is fairly high, and some hardware issues as well. So as I said, I think it's a really good paper. I think they've been very open and honest about their results. And I think it's something that we can all believe and benchmark against. And I believe their results. I don't think we're going to get any better results from anywhere else. I've seen them do the operation. They're very slick at it. And I suppose the things I was thinking about this is, well, the femoral head monitoring, that's very cool. The SPECT CT, I'm not sure it changes very much. It changed things for their stable group, but not for their unstable group. They say that in their paper. And when you look at, say, again, you know, the Stanmore guys, Mr. Cattrall, Mr. Najad, and you look at their long-term follow-ups, They had AVN rates of about 10%. And one of the big things that Mr. Cattrall talks about is the 3-week wait. So you're making that acute slip a chronic slip. And even in Mr. Najjad's paper that was published later in the BJJ, they said that they found that actually waiting at least 1 week improved their AVN rates. So I do think that that's an area that needs to be explored in any future research. And I think it's safe to conclude that just doing a modified DUN doesn't mean that you're going to get rid of AVN in that nasty group, the unstable severe slip. But yeah, that's my take on that paper. I don't know if you guys had anything you wanted to add.
Yeah, I think the main observation, you know, again, in terms of when I'm reading these things, I'm always thinking about my own practice. And I mean, ultimately, you know, it doesn't make me think that I should be doing this procedure, because the huge volume of cases that they're seeing. I mean, I remember, you know, I came away from Sydney really very enthused by this procedure. Yeah. Because just restoring the anatomy to these hips when they do well looks like a fabulous thing to have done for the patient. But if they get AVN, it is catastrophic. And I mean, they clearly had a bit of a learning curve with this, because in the early part of the study, before they started using their intraoperative perfusion monitoring, 4 of the 19 stable hips got AVN. And now they didn't have any in the later part of the study. But, you know, really, those stable slips would never have got AVN, you know, highly unlikely that they'd have got AVN. So basically, I think what that's telling me is that unless you're doing 200 over 10 years, you probably shouldn't be doing it, because particularly in those stable patients, because they've got so much more to lose if you give them AVN. And that was kind of over time, although I came back from Sydney very enthusiastic about thinking of doing it. I wasn't able to replicate the kind of volume of patients, nor the support of other consultants and other specialists who are experts in learning this procedure. So, you know, I think it's something that really should only be for very specialist centres that have a really good number.
Yeah.
Anish, I thought it was a really good paper as well, actually, really interesting, very thorough, and I thought honest. One thing you guys will actually be able to tell me, because I couldn't really figure it out, is they were suggesting, and maybe I completely got it wrong, is that you always get a waveform in the head. But presumably there'll be some hips, the acute unstables, where the die is cast already and it's dead.
Yeah, I think they did say there were some where they couldn't find a waveform. When you're reading through the paper, I'm sure.
I think they said that was 100% predictive of the head going on to then collapse. So that's where they're saying that that monitoring had an 100% positive and negative predictive value for predicting collapse and AVN. So some of them were dead. I think the other thing to highlight, you know, you said about the complication rate being 27.5%, which sounds absolutely horrific. Yeah. But quite a few of those were due to the AVN, so needing a total hip replacement and recon. So that's not actually, you know, in a lot of those unstable hips, they were probably going to go on to have AVN anyway. So, you know, so although it is a high complication rate and the dislocations are a nightmare to deal with, it's not quite as bad as it sounds when you take that into consideration.
No, but I think it's in terms of consenting, and I don't think you could say that this is exclusively for the modified DUN either. I think this is if you are doing any sort of intracapsular osteotomy for severe unstable slips. We've got producer Pranay telling us here on the chat, number one reason for having hip replacement as a teenager is AVN post-SUFI, BJJ paper 2020. As you say, Sally, I think the thing is, when you get AVN and you see that on your post-op x-rays, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? So I don't do the modified DUN. We do a fish-type cuneiform osteotomy using the anterior approach at Norwich. And it is just because when we came back from Sydney, it was a little bit far out, wasn't it? And I think there are people around the UK doing it now. I think we don't know what the right answer is still for this group. And I think there's a randomized controlled trial that's going to be happening, isn't there?
Yeah, no, we send ours all to Reading. So Nev Davies, who followed you guys actually in Sydney.
And he was before us. He's older.
Was he before you?
Okay. He might be fresh-faced.
He was with me my first 6 months.
Okay, yeah. So they do it there, and I think because of the numbers, if someone is going to do it, they should all go to them in the region. And he's had some fantastic results and some less good, but you know, when it goes well, it goes very, very well.
Yeah.
One last thing I found interesting with the paper, we're just looking at the mean time to collapse and like the range of collapse, yeah. And I thought that was useful just to, you know, further information to speak to the patients about when you're just monitoring them afterwards, and when you're home and dry.
I think it was 7 months, wasn't it? Because I always say up to 2 years, but I think everything happened by 14 months, but 7 months was the mean. And as I said, it's every time they come back for an x-ray, I'm holding my breath, asking the registrar to look away from their monitor so I can just have a little moment just to get used to what I might be dealing with. I hate those moments. It's the same with DDA. It's the same with all my operations, actually, even the curly toes. Yeah. Right. Okay, so moving on. So it is Christmas. Is it beginning to feel a lot like Christmas for you guys?
I'm pointing the Christmas tree behind me.
Yeah.
Amish is looking very festive. My Wi-Fi Christmas doesn't work well enough by my tree, so I can't show you a tree. I'm sorry.
Just not good enough. So guys, favorite Christmas song. It doesn't have to be a Christmas number one, but what would you say your favorite Christmas songs are?
Well, the kids are always playing Feliz Navidad. So I generally have that ringing in my head constantly.
Moving on, Alpesh, yes.
It's got to be E17, Stay Another Day.
Oh, you are joking.
Seriously, it's where the hard men from E17 became soft. I mean, yeah. It's great.
I would just like to say we didn't actually set this up. He's actually saying this. I think he actually genuinely means it. I'm a bit worried about this now. Man, okay, fair enough. Do you know, I have so many. Right now, this month, so this year, it's, do you remember Mad World from Donnie Darko? Tears for Fears. I feel like it's actually really appropriate for where we are in life right now. You just think, I do like that kind of somber thing. And, you know, I used to hate the Pogues. When I was growing up, I absolutely hated the Pogues. That bloke, I've forgotten his name. I want to say Shane McGowan, but it's not Shane McGowan. But he had no teeth. I swear, he was like at the piano looking really... It was just like a scrope. And now I love that song. But actually, having said that, do you know what song does get me every time? Is the first Band-Aid. The first Band-Aid song, every time that comes on, I feel really guilty about Christmas. It takes me back to like, do you remember, Alpesh might not actually, but Sally, do you remember Michael Burke in Ethiopia for the news? No, I'm bringing a downer onto the...
Well, possibly, but I don't know.
See, it just makes... And it's that line, you know... tonight, thank God it's them instead of you. You just think, man, that's a little bit harsh, isn't it? But okay.
Oh, look, our producer's here.
Right, brilliant. Pranay, mate, what's your favourite Christmas track?
It's just got to be the Christmas song, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. Any version of it, any version. Usually an R&B update version, but Frank Sinatra original is always great.
Yeah. It was in Australia, actually. When we were in Australia, Christmas for me was, it was in their summer and it didn't feel like Christmas. That's the first time ever I downloaded and listened to Christmas music. And I was playing it in theatres and the guys in theatres got really upset because I said, I'm going to play some Christmas songs. And then on came like Slade and, you know, Wizard. And they're like, these aren't carols. But I was like, and I think in Australia, they just didn't really get Christmas, you know, kind of pop music. Right. Last bit of trivia, because we are trying to teach people things here. Which of the following have had the most Christmas number ones? Okay. Spice Girls, Queen, or Lad Baby? Oh, Alpesh has put three. So are you going for a Lad Baby? And it is Lad Baby. And I believe they've had three Christmas number ones, whereas I believe the Spice Girls had two. And Queen have had two, but it was Bohemian Rhapsody each time. See, we're just educating people on so many different points. Right. Okay. So now we're moving on to Alpesh, your paper.
Okay. Great. So thank you very much for that entertaining interlude. And so I'm going to discuss a paper. Is gastrocnemius tightness a normal finding in children? So this is by Liana Racci et al. out of Trondheim in Norway, JBGS American, from, I think it was November. It was a particularly, I thought, a non-JBGS American paper, and it was, it wasn't particularly technical, but I thought it was quite an interesting paper. I'll go through it. They're saying that gastrocnemius tightness is implicated in a number of pathologies, Achilles tendinopathy, severs, pes planus, plantar fasciitis, and basically said, look, we need a bit more normal data. What, you know, what's tight? How tight is too tight? I think sometimes we get carried away with the treatments, but we don't know enough about the normal data. So it was a simple study. They identified 204 children through various schools in Trondheim, and two clinicians gauged their ankle range of movement using a silver-scaled test and a goniometer. And documented this. As well as this, they looked at foot posture because of the relationship between Achilles tightness or gastroc tightness and potential plantar valgus feet. So they looked at the foot posture using ink pad and this index called the Csipo-Szmirnak index, which is one of many footprint indices to measure foot posture. And they also looked at symptoms and to basically find out if in the last 3 months any child couldn't walk more than a kilometer or had pain. And then this alongside other data, including their demographics and weight, were put together in the melting pot to see what the relationships were between all of these things. And they found that ankle dorsiflexion decreased with increasing age. And they looked at previous literature and they said, if you apply a threshold for less than or equal to 5 degrees, with the knee extended as denoting plantar flexor contracture, essentially, then 54.9% of these kids were affected. And they said, well, you know, that's a bit too much, really. Whereas if you put the threshold at 0%, then a 0 degrees, sorry, and then only 3.7% of this population would be regarded as pathological. And that would be almost consistent with, you know, our sort of two standard deviations from the mean. Other interesting facts in this paper were that they did not find a relationship between symptoms and the plantar flexor tightness, gastroc tightness, and they didn't actually find a relationship between the ankle range of movement and foot posture, because often you associate equinus with flat foot posture. So that was interesting. They had a moderately sized sample. So things I thought good about this paper were that you can never have too much normal data, I don't think. So that was good. I thought their methods overall represented a clinical scenario, which is how we're going to see the patient. You could criticize and say, you know, it's not particularly precise method of measuring, but this is what we do in clinic, and we don't often use a goniometer there. And they commented on the error as well. So instead of using obscure statistics to define how repeatable and reliable, they just said actually 2.8 degrees was our kind of range of which we thought was our error range. Above this was kind of significant. So that was good. And also the other thing, each child has 2 feet and they have and each foot is not an independent specimen. And often in orthopedics, it just gets lumped together as, yeah, we had 10 patients, 20 legs. So our sample was 20 legs. It's not, unless you do something to adapt for that. And they did adapt for that in their statistics. So I like that because I'm a bit of a pedant. And actually it's more robust statistics. I think this was really interesting. The reason particularly it sort of resonated with me is that we're sort of in discussion at the moment in BISCOS about undertaking studies looking at toe walking. And obviously, we need to define what is normal before we can define what's abnormal. And I think this probably is consistent with what we think. We'd never say that someone had a really clinically significant contracture if they got past plantar grade. So plantar grade seems like a reasonable point. Yeah. And this sort of is backed up by this study. So I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was one of those papers. It's so simple. I'm surprised it's in the American JBJS, but that's not a bad thing. It's just normally they want much bigger numbers and much more hard science. I love the sound of that digital goniometer. I'm going to try and get one of those because that's what they used. What I was interested in actually is that CSI is what they called that footprint thing, wasn't it? But apparently 14% had cavers feet. And for me, I was like, wow, okay, I get excited when I see a cavers foot in a child, because this was children from about the age of 5 up to about 14. Is that right? And so actually, you're so used to seeing flat feet in this group that, you know, for me, cavers would be like, oh, you better do something. But actually, it's quite common, isn't it? What about you, Sally? Do you, what were your take? What was your thought on this paper?
Yeah, well, I mean, Alpesh covered it all very thoroughly, didn't he? So, I mean, yeah, I guess the main thing for me was the message that, A, you know, if it's, as long as they achieve at least plantar grade, then that's probably normal. And B, the fact that I've been taught all this time that, well, a flat foot might be causing, might be caused by a tight TA is maybe not true.
I didn't want to point that out, actually, because then that's like a solid fact that we're now saying might not be the case. And it's a great get out in clinic, isn't it? It's like, oh, yeah, you're getting this foot pain and look at your foot. It's because you've got a tight TA. Look, you've only got 5 degrees of dorsiflexion with your knee extended. Oh, yeah, you better go see the physios. That's all gone now.
But I think it's a bit of cause and effect. I think, you know, probably the TA tightening is probably, potentially secondary, whereas this is looking at more primary. I mean, I think that CSI, the index, is debatable about whether that's the best method to assess foot posture. The other thing, interestingly, so I was looking at the BMIs. I did the very complex calculations. They had weights and they had heights. It took me a long time to figure out the BMIs, but I did. I got there in the end. And their range was, you know, they were all between like 15 and 21. So, I mean, this was a stark contrast. We know that a flat foot is associated with increased BMI, potentially. Yeah. So this was a very healthy population and
Scandinavian country. That's what it is there.
So it was pre-pandemic, obviously after pandemic.
Right. And one of the things that actually producer Pranay has asked me to highlight is we will be putting show notes up. I don't know whether we put show notes up so that everyone can get the information, because we've got written crib sheets, or whether we do it so that everyone has to send us in some complimentary feedback by email, and then we'll send this so that they can actually stick it in as a PDF onto their appraisal file and then just get points for CPD. We'll have to have a discussion offline about that one. Brilliant. Right. So moving on to the last bit. Okay. So my little bite sizes. I really had problems with this. So we've had lots of chat. This is our first podcast. We're trying to keep it short and sweet. So there's loads of stuff that we read that we're not going to be able to include, but we might include in the notes. So the first paper I'm going to talk about is Pennock et al. That's from North America, and it's in December's issue of the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery. And it's a clavicle paper, and it's by a multi-center group called the Function After Adolescent Clavicle Trauma and Surgery. So lots of big names from around North America. And it tells us what we already know, but people don't want to accept because they want to operate. So it's a multi-center prospective trial. In 10 to 18 year olds, the mean age was 14 years. They had completely displaced clavicle fractures. And what they basically found was, when you compared the initial radiograph with one that was at a mean of 11 weeks, 25% of those radiographs did show a change in parameters, 84% showed improvement. So there was actually a reduction in the superior displacement, and there was an increase in length. So the whole shortening had actually undone itself slightly. So as early as that. And they said that actually some of it's not just remodeling, it might just be things like muscle spasm, sternocleidomastoid relaxing. So they're really saying that actually this is even more reason not to operate on this age group. But it's something that, you know, I think there's a big divide, and they say that in their paper, between pediatric orthopedic surgeons and adult orthopods. And they're saying, when you look at this group, if they were adults, a lot of people would have operated on them. So that's my first paper.
Wasn't there something in the BJJ earlier this year about adolescent clavicle fractures and saying that, again, supporting that you don't need to operate on them?
Yeah.
Did I hallucinate that, or was that in there?
No, I believe you're right. I think there's so much evidence out there that you don't need to operate, but I don't know what it's like for you guys. The tide still seems to be. There was another interesting one, actually, and I forgot which journal that was in, where they talked about cosmesis. And that might, in fact, that was a Norwegian study, I think. People say, oh, another reason to fix these guys is because they prefer the cosmetic appearance. And actually, in this study, people that had surgery were less impressed with the cosmetic appearance than those who didn't. So I think whatever reason you're looking for to operate doesn't exist, but it's just what we keep facing. And then moving on, I was saying international orthopedics, a paper from Iran, September 2021. It was a prospective randomized controlled trial looking at surgical treatment of flexible flat foot. And they compared subtalar arthrorhesis with the calcaneo stop screw with lateral column lengthening. Now, I have to say, I don't really do either of those for flexible flat foot. I try and avoid doing anything for flexible flat foot. Any of you big on any surgical things for flexible flat foot?
I do mostly lateral column lengthening with the plantar medial plication and medial cuneiform osteotomy if required. But I've done it in the last 6 months. I've done a few cases of subtalar arthrorhesis actually.
Okay. And what are your thoughts?
So one lad was a spina bifida lad with flexible flat feet, but he wasn't braceable at all. And he was getting pressure sores, just even if you look at his skin. So he wouldn't have been a candidate for osteotomies in a foot. He would have had significant complications. So I thought, well, let's try the arthrorhesis. If it doesn't work, we haven't really lost anything. So it's holding at the moment. Whether that remains the case, I'll report back in a year or two.
Right. And Sally, have you been doing anything like that?
Well, like you, Anish, it's something I tried to avoid, really. I mean, I've done a tiny number of calcaneal lengthening osteotomies for those patients that really are moaning so much with their flexible flat foot. And again, like Alpesh mentioned, they're often kids that are, maybe autistic or, not necessarily a major diagnosis associated, but, a bit of some kind of association. Maybe I'm just not doing it very well, but I've not been really impressed with the results with those patients. They still look to have a bit of a, because it's so flexible, they still look to have a bit of a flat foot. So really, that's made me shy away from wanting to offer it at all. But then the whole subtalar arthrorhesis, I was laughing to myself, the noise you made when Alpesh said he'd done some, because whenever we talk about this in BISCOS meetings, it's always like very sharp intake of breath. Ooh, you're doing that. And like it's some kind of blacklisted procedure. I'm probably not well read enough to comment on whether that is justified or not, but I guess that's put me off. My other observation would be, I'm never quite sure. I mean, it's a similar kind of thing to doing a Grice arthrodesis, really, isn't it? In terms of what you're actually doing, it's just you're putting something artificial rather than bone in. And I mean, certainly when we were in Sydney, the CP patients were getting quite a few of the Grice arthrodesis, and that seems like something that worked quite well.
And I think this is, you're right, and that's why I picked this paper actually, because everyone does do the bite, teeth and suck in. Now the only thing, my one criticism for this paper, the thing that makes me worry, is that they were doing it on children between the ages of 8 and 12, so mean age for this paper was 10, and they'd excluded all the neuromuscular and the syndromic feet. They didn't include them in the analysis. There were good kind of, in terms of research methodology, it was well done. They worked out they needed 36 in each group. And this was 72 flexible flat feet between 2018 and 2019. That's a lot of flat feet that someone has been operating on. But what they did find is, with a mean follow-up of 18 months, is that they were all okay. That subtalar arthrorhesis did as well as the lateral column lengthening. Family satisfaction was higher in the subtalar arthrorhesis group. And apart from calcaneal pitch being higher in the lateral column lengthening, all the other radiologic measures were normal, similar between the two groups. And what you say, Sally, actually, even in that paper, when they showed an example of a lateral column lengthening and the clinical result afterwards, it still looked pretty flat, but just not as severely flat as it did at the beginning. And so there's this paper that does suggest that subtalar arthrorhesis isn't the work of the devil. Alpesh has become a little bit of a convert, and actually Current Concepts in Edinburgh in November 2019. I remember there was a discussion about the surgical management of flexible flat foot, but it was Colin Bruce from Alderhay in the audience who started telling us about his experience with subtalar arthrorhesis. Because the other thing in this, I don't know what you're going to do, Alpesh, but everyone has always said you should take the screw out. But in this paper, they only took it out in one out of their 36 patients. And a lot of people, Colin Bruce said, he's going to leave them all in there. What's your thought?
So before I did them, I spoke to a lot of people actually, and in the past I've reviewed a number of papers related to the subject. And so I got a rule of thirds from one surgeon I spoke to. So in one third, the implant will be spat out by the foot. Right. In another third, it will work well. And in a final third, it will maintain foot alignment, but it will cause discomfort. And so I think the party line is that you should take it out after 2 or 3 years, really. But, ultimately, if they get to 3 years down the line and they're really comfortable and doing really well, question is, would you want to subject them to further surgery? Because removal of implant has its own potential complication risk as well, although this would be pretty small.
Yeah. So that's why I think it is interesting. I wonder whether there will be a tide that slowly turns. We'll see.
I was just going to say, do you think the follow-up is long enough in that paper? 18 months. I mean, you were talking, Alpesh, about them maybe having symptoms 2 or 3 years down the line due to this thing needing removing. I mean, that does have a bearing then on their results, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely. And I think that's what's going to be really interesting is seeing what's going on at 5 years. I think that's when you want to see what's going on with those implants that have been left in and are they causing any problems? But I'm not aware of any long-term follow-ups yet in this group of patients. And hopefully people will publish it. That's the thing, isn't it? Often things get published when they're new and shiny and then people forget about it afterwards. Hopefully the guys in Iran will carry on with this workload that they're doing and we'll have some really good results in years to come. Right. And then whizzing through my other papers. So JPOB, November 21, the team from Sheffield, including Mark Flowers and Nick Nicolau, they've published what I think is a small but important study. And I don't know if you guys are using those, they call them the unthreaded screws, but they're basically those pegs, aren't they, the proximal screw thread for Sufi. And they've compared 9 patients that had these unthreaded screws with a larger group of matched patients that had the standard screws. And what they say is that whilst the unthreaded screws did allow for more growth for sure, as a consequence, they often grew off those screws and had to have revisions. So the relative risk ratio of revision surgery for that group was 6.57. And so they say that they cannot advocate use of this screw. And I think that's really important because its use, I believe, is increasing. People are looking at it more and more. I think Southampton also presented their results, didn't they, at BISCOS earlier this year, and said that it's safe. They didn't say it's better, but they said it's safe. So I think it will be interesting to see what other papers come out. But for me, this was I'm not going to rush to use this. I've been a bit cynical, and I am going to watch and wait to see what happens. And then in terms of, there was another good paper from Sheffield. Yes, I was a fellow there and I loved the place, but it was just because there are good papers. But this is September 21, JPO, where they published their experience. This is JPO allowing, again, a paper that's just about clinic experience during COVID. And they basically moved to the BISCOS and Alderhey guidelines. And what they said was, following that, they had fewer follow-up appointments, fewer x-rays, no increase in complications. And if they carried this on, they'd save about £96,000 in follow-ups, and they would save another £90,000 in plastering visits. And that's just for one hospital, one service, and they had no increase in complications. Do have a look at the paper if you are thinking about setting up virtual clinics. Obviously, everyone knows here, big disclosure and disclaimer, I'm a big fan of virtual fracture clinics. So for me, this was it's telling me what I know, but I think many of you there are still haters. Sally's looking at the floor in a kind of, yeah, right. Did any of you guys move to virtual?
Oh, no, I'm completely with you. I 100% am with you. Since COVID, we've switched to everything virtual for fracture clinics, peds and adults since COVID, and it's been a really, really good thing. I'm very pleased with it.
I think that's the thing, that COVID, I think there might have been a lot of angst about, oh, do we try this new thing? And COVID just pushed it, didn't it? I haven't come across anyone who's regretted it so far. And then last couple of papers, and these are really just things that I think are interesting. One was risk factors for intellectual disability in children with spastic cerebral palsy. Okay, so this is Archive of Diseases in Childhood, and this was the October 2021 issue. And it's a study looking at the Northern Ireland Cerebral Palsy Register. So one thing I was like, wow, Northern Ireland have got a register as well. We don't. And they looked at about 1,500 children born between 1981 and 2008. intellectual disability, particularly if severe. Okay, so looking at severe intellectual disability, so an IQ of around less than 50 is noted on that register by a healthcare professional for each patient. And what they found, I think, was kind of obvious. It was a little bit like that BJJ paper from Stanmore, but actually some of it wasn't quite so obvious. So if you have bilateral spastic cerebral palsy, you are more likely to have a severe intellectual disability than if you have unilateral spastic CP. I think that's not so, I think that's kind of obvious, but it was good to see evidence of this. They found that it really relates to your GMFCS. So if you're GMFCS 1, your chances are 4%, GMFCS 2 and 3, 14%, GMFCS 4, 40%, and GMFCS 5, 80% had severe disability. If you were born at term with spastic cerebral palsy, your chances of having an intellectual, severe intellectual disability were 31%. That's compared to moderately preterm was 14% and very preterm 23%, which I thought was actually the opposite of what I'd expect. I'd have thought the earlier you're born, the more likely you are to have severe intellectual disability. So I don't know, you know, this isn't the kind of thing we normally have to counsel families about, but it does sometimes come up because often we are the people that make the diagnosis of cerebral palsy. And I don't know what you guys find, but it's always a very difficult conversation where you're saying, I think your child has cerebral palsy, but don't worry, the pediatrician will sort that out. They don't really want to leave your clinic room without you giving them more information, which is understandable, isn't it? Oh, I think your child has this condition that's going to change their life and yours forever, but don't worry, someone will contact you and speak to you a bit more in 6 months' time. So that's why I thought this was kind of interesting as well, just because it again adds a little bit more information for me to share with families and patients to a degree. And then can I do one last bullet point paper, which something that's close to my heart, and it's about medical students and their sense of belonging affecting an interest in orthopedic surgery careers. Okay, this was a qualitative investigation, so it's in clinical orthopedics and related research from October 2021. It is very touchy-feely. I can see Sally, she's got scorn on her face right now. Going, what? But it did find what we all think we know. So people derive their sense of belonging, medical students in orthopedics, based on how closely they feel their identity aligns with the stereotype. And according to the results of the interviews, the stereotype is white, male, or athletic, or white, male, and athletic. And so if you were in this group, so if you're a member of the in-group, they loved doing orthopedics. When they did orthopedics, it basically reinforced those identity alignments and then led to increased interest and continued engagement. But if you were in the out-group, so if you didn't see yourself as part of that stereotype, it was completely the opposite. The more you experienced orthopedics, the more you hated it. And I think that's really interesting. I think for pediatric orthopedic surgery, it has implications because we are a very different and diverse bunch anyway. But I think we're sitting there trying to get more people and increase diversity just in terms of cognition and everything else in pediatric orthopedics and orthopedics. And I think this is something we all want to bear in mind. And I think there's movement, but maybe being aware of this and making sure that medical students get exposed to loads of us, they can see that. I mean, look at me, I'm not athletic. awkward silence. They're thinking, do we say yes or no?
Well, I was thinking across my entire department. I don't want to cast aspersions on the athleticism of my colleagues, but there are a very small number of people in my department who are white, male, and athletic. So I'm not sure that the Americans were getting. I think they were American, weren't they? Their stereotypes right.
And I think that's the thing. Maybe the stereotype is different in this country now. Right. Any comments on any of those papers, guys? So something to say is that, yes, as we said, this will all be available in writing. So you can look at our notes and pretend that they're your own. Anything else that you guys wanted to add before we wrap up?
Well, I'd like to say thank you very much for the opportunity to educate me. Thank you.
I'm just going to say that E17 is still the best Christmas song, putting it out there.
That's a long, awkward silence. Thank you very much for joining us, Sally. And you did live up to expectations. I was telling everyone you'd be great, and you really were. So thank you very much. And actually, who's going to BISCOS in Maidstone? It's going to be awesome. It's at a racetrack. They've got an upper limb theme. It is going to be brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. It's just going to be lovely to see people face to face, provided that the Omicron virus variant doesn't take over the world. So we'll see. But we're planning on doing this about every quarter. So our next one will be after BizCos. And hopefully we're going to give you some highlights from there as well. Talk about the papers that we thought were really rocking it. And guys, if you've been listening to this, then hopefully that means you know where to find it. But if you didn't listen to this and you don't know where to find it, then what you want to do, it's on the BizCos website, but you can also find it on Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts. And obviously BizCos are all over social media, well, on Twitter. And you can follow at BizCos_UK. And if you want to get in touch with us, if there's anything that we said that offended you, and you want to provoke us, please email podcast@bizcos.org.uk. But thank you very much for listening. Big thanks to Pranay for sorting all the shiny bits out for this. We couldn't do it without him. And yeah, thanks. Last thanks, I suppose, you've got to say to the BizCos board for letting us do this, and the BizCos Education Committee as well for all their support. They've been really helpful and really have been supportive. So thank you very much, guys, and have a Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.